All right, and we should be live. Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you back for another monthly Ask Anything Money Q&A with the financial advisors that are recommended by Wealthion. I'm joined here, as usual, by Lance Roberts from Real Investment Advice and from John Lodra and my Preston lead partners at New Harbor Financial. Guys, how are you all?
Yeah, great.
Hey, good morning, Adam. Good morning, Lance.
Course, good morning, everyone. Good to be here.
All right, guys. Well, look, new year. Big question, is it going to be new markets in the new year, or are we going to see a continuation of the bruising and the bear market that we had in 2022? So folks watching, this is your chance to ask any questions you like of our panel of money experts here. My job here will be looking in the live chat and trying to surface questions as best I'm able. If you're watching this on replay, welcome. So folks, if you're watching live right now and can't stay for the entire session, don't worry. This video is going to become a replay video right after the live event ends. All right. With that, guys, let me just ask a question or two to get the ball rolling here, and then I'll start pulling questions from the live stream. Got a couple of big announcements this week. Maybe we should just start with Jerome Powell, because everyone is still ultra focused on the Fed in terms of where they think the market's going to go. Jerome Powell, Fed chair, will be speaking tomorrow. What do you guys think his main message will be, and what do you think the market reaction will be? Lance, why don't we start with you, because I'm guessing you probably already talked about this in your morning show.
Well, actually, we wrote about it in this past weekend's newsletter as well, which we published on Saturday at the website. But look, the message is the same. FOMC minutes from December said we're going to hike rates until we are sure. And this is a key differentiator here. What the Fed said, what Powell said specifically, and it's in those minutes, is that they are going to hike rates until inflation is coming down in a sustainable trajectory to its target. Now, it didn't say they were going to hike rates until we were at 2% inflation. They just want to ensure that inflation is on a steady trend lower towards that 2% inflation mark. What they're terrified of is what happened back in the 70s, where you had a spike in inflation, it came down, and then it reaccelerated again. That's their big concern. And this employment data, while it was much stronger than expected, wages did come down a smidge. They're still going, but they're not going up as fast. So everybody kind of got real excited over that report last week and ran markets up. But the wage price spiral is the big thing the Fed is focused on, because, again, as inflation comes in, corporations have to raise prices. That includes wages. And that's one thing they need to make sure they've got under control. The only way you do that is to slow economic growth.
All right. So, John, I'm coming to you in just a second. But just because you mentioned CPI and the importance of the disinflation that we're seeing and the rate of disinflation that we're seeing, right. CPI comes out this Thursday, the December CPI. Any particular prediction on what we're going to get?
You're asking me?
I'm asking you, and then we're going to go to John.
Sorry. I think we're still going to see inflation at a fair, you know, it's not going to come down markedly, you know, in this next report. One thing, too, is that we've seen disinflation here recently, and that's because the year-over-year comparisons in inflation are pretty large. Going into the first part of this year, we're going to see some 1% comparisons, 1.2% comparisons. So we could see inflation come down pretty quickly over the next few months. And that's going to give the bulls kind of a lot of relief. And they're going to say, see, inflation's coming down. The Fed's going to pivot, so forth and so on. But after about March, April, those comparisons start to drop to fairly low levels. So we could see inflation kind of stabilize at a higher level, potentially even tick up, depending on kind of what's happening economically. So again, yeah, weaker inflation, we'll see that on Wednesday. The question is going to be is how the Fed interprets that in terms of their outlook.
All right, great. So John, coming to you, would love to give you a chance to react to Lance just said, and if you want to add anything to it, just wanted to start here on the Fed, because it's what we've been talking about all year and probably will keep talking about it until the markets stop trying to front run it. Any particular color to add around what Lance said, and then also let us know your CPI predictions as well.
I have no clue about the CPI. No, I mean, it is pretty clear there's a disinflationary trend, but it takes time for that to get back to the safe zone. In fact, I'm going to try and share a chart here, and I'm going to give props to our friend and your friend, Tavi Costa, this chart he pulled together. So hey, let me just share my screen here. And let's see here. I think I might have to move this over here. Let's see. Bear with me here just a second. And then can you see this chart?
We can't. Let's see here. I think, are you clicking present and then share screen?
Yeah. What are you seeing? You still seeing me?
We're just seeing your handsome face.
So basically just put your hand in the right direction of where inflation's heading to, and we'll know what the chart says.
Yeah, John, maybe talk to it, and then you can email it to me, and I'll...
All right, I'll stop that for now. And... Can you all hear me? I'm having a wicked delay, and...
Okay. Yeah, we hear you fine.
Okay. Sorry about that. Well, anyways,
just keep talking.
Just keep talking. All right.
Okay. I think I'm back here.
Okay.
I was getting some real long delays there. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we can hear you just fine now, John.
Sounds like you still are. Here, Mike, why don't we go over to you, and John, you can triage your system in the interim.
All right, here I am. Same question, Adam?
Yeah, basically just, yeah. You know, anything to add on top of Lance's comments on the Fed, because it's still driving so much of the action, then if you have anything to say about where you think CPI might be going. And really, I'm more curious of, do you think it's going to go down faster than the market's expecting, slower? You know, I don't need a number.
No, I think Lance and John said these things take time, but there is some disinflation going on. And the inflation numbers that we saw last year were a result of the pig through the python type thing that you talk about so many times on your program, Adam. And it's everyone was kind of freaking out and, you know, saying, oh, my God, inflation's at 9%. That's year over year inflation. It's not likely to stay there persistently. It's likely to drift back down. And in fact, it already has been. I think the latest number was closer to 8 or so. I don't know the exact number. I would expect maybe this week will be in the 7s. And maybe a year from now down to, you know, somewhere around 4%. I think that inflation is here to stay, you know, particularly with the different types of pressures that were talked about. Lance talked about wage price pressures. That's certainly going to continue, almost certainly, and will start to eat into corporate profit margins too, which is a big risk for the S&P earnings and thus stock prices. So I would expect maybe this week 7 and a year from now drift down towards maybe 4 for the longer term. I don't really predict a hyperinflation spike anytime soon, maybe after we have some kind of major crisis and the Fed prints a lot more money. But no, I think that the Fed is likely going to be successful in continuing to keep inflation relatively contained. And I hate to give them props for that because, you know, so far they've actually done the same thing with the stock market. The stock market's been in a controlled, really kind of listless decline, down maybe 18-19% on the S&P. And at some point we think that changes and we have a sharp break lower. But as far as inflation goes, it's not, I don't think, an immediate concern. It should continue to drift lower.
Okay. Well, Lance, here, I'll come to you next. We're still waiting for John to pipe back in. When you and I talked this weekend, you mentioned that there's a convergence right now of kind of the major DMAs, right? One of the technical data sets that you look at. I think it was like the 20-day, the 50-day, and the 100-day DMA, where like all converging basically around 3,900. Right. And you were saying that, you know, if the market breaks out above that, then there's probably going to be, you know, it's going to run for a ways. We're seeing another up day in the market right now. So we are, you know, in the 3,900 range at this point in time right now. If you could just talk to the importance of this, if it does pop, you know, how much you think we might get from this run. but also this morning's article, one of the articles this morning, and I'm trying to kind of combine several different questions here in the live stream. We saw Lululemon basically disappoint in terms of its forward guidance here, which is some evidence of the earnings recession that people, you know, believe is going to happen in the first half of this year. So is there a potential that as the earnings data comes in, it might kill the enthusiasm of a, you know, a breakthrough of this this technical level we're talking about?
Yeah, well, so a couple of things. One, you know, you're trying to combine technicals with fundamentals, and those don't always kind of run together. And the reason is that technicals are very short-term indicators, right? So we're just simply talking about, hey, we're at a price level that has normally provided resistance to the markets. And, you know, you want to be a little bit careful there. If you're below it, if you're above it, then that gives you a little bit more room to run. So let's talk technicals first, and we'll just hit on fundamentals real quick. So technically, yeah, I mean, the market's improving a lot here. We just registered a MACD buy signal yesterday. That's been on Friday. And that's been a very good indicator last year to either increase or reduce exposure. We're adding a little bit of exposure today, onboarding some new accounts. And so this week we'll be working on kind of going through portfolios and looking for areas that we can safely add some equity exposure into. Now, this is a short-term trade, right? So this rally might go to 4,000, 4,100, but you're about to run into the 200-day moving average, the downtrend that goes back to January of last year. Now, if we get above that, you've got a very different ball game at that point. So, you know, there's the potential here for this market to really have some legs. So, you know, you can't discount that. You've also got to start thinking about the possibilities, and you and I have talked about this before, the possibilities versus probabilities. Everybody's bearish. Everybody thinks that we're going to have a recession this year. Everybody thinks we're going to have another 20 or 30% down year in the market. Everybody thinks we're going to have an earnings recession. That's common wisdom across Wall Street. Problem is when everybody thinks that, something else tends to happen. Mm-hmm. So you have to at least start building in the case for what if earnings don't come down as much as we expect? What if somehow, because look, we do have strong employment, that data is still holding up here, surprisingly. Now we can, you and I can debate about the employment data, but the there. So what if we don't have a recession? What happens if we do somehow avoid a recession? What happens if earnings don't fall as much as we expect? Market could get a bit of a rally here. So again, I think you have to give that some credence. I don't say go, I wouldn't bet 100% of my money on that thesis. But again, when everybody is bearish, when everybody thinks the market's coming to an end, you've got to start building a bit of a probability or a possibility, I should say, that something else occurs. And so again, just, you know, give this market some technical room here. I think that's a reasonable possibility right now. Now, as far as earnings go, look, earnings are going to be better than expected because we've lowered earnings by 12% since June of last year. So earnings estimates for the first quarter have come down a lot. We're about to go into what I call the millennial earnings season. This is where everybody gets a trophy because we lower the bar so much. Everybody later on this year, watch what companies say. Lululemon's a good example. Now, Lululemon is super overpriced athletic wear, right? So, you know, you're starting to get out of the reach of, you know, your middle-class Americans. They're having to cut back. They're having to, you know, start, you know, making decisions to shop at Target or an Academy versus Lululemon. So not surprising, these higher-end companies are going to start to see some impact on earnings. But watch what these companies say. We kick off bank earnings next week. Watch what these companies are saying about the rest of this year in terms of their earnings outlook. I think earnings do have to come down more. We're still well elevated above long-term growth trends. And that's certainly going to weigh on the potential upside of whatever rally we get in the market.
Okay. All right. So, you know, you do a really good job, Lance, of always reminding us that when everybody thinks something's going to happen, it's probably going to be something else. And we talked a little bit about Charles Hugh Smith, who was observing, and I finally found out who he was getting this from. It was Brent Johnson from Santiago Capital, the dollar milkshake guy, who just raised the question, hey, what if the black swan of 2023 is the Fed actually managing the soft landing? Because that's the one thing that nobody expects, right? But look, moving on to something that, again, everybody does expect. John, I'll come to you with this if you're...
Real quick, let me jump off because you mentioned soft landing. There's been three cases historically where the Fed has managed a soft landing. And a soft landing is when there's no recession. The first was 84 when you had the savings and loan crisis due to higher interest rates. The second was 1994 where you didn't have a recession, but you had a bond market crisis. And the third was 2018 where the markets declined 20% and then you had a recession. So just because the Fed engineers a soft landing doesn't mean other stuff doesn't happen.
Right. Doesn't mean we get out unscathed. That's a great thing to underscore. All right. So John, if hopefully your system's back up and running here, I want to come to you with this question, because again, it's about another thing that sort of everybody is on the same side of the boat generally, where the market basically, you know, is predicting that the Fed is going to pivot at some point, right? You know, and right now the markets are in a big tug of war with the Fed's jawboning, right? The Fed's trying to say, hey, we're super serious. We're going to raise rates to 5 or higher, maybe even 7, you know, Bullard's dropping that trial balloon. We're going to hold it there for a long time. And the market's basically saying, nah, I don't think so. And even the after this last week when they floated that 7% trial balloon, I believe that the market expectations for rate hikes fell. So, you know, not only are they not agreeing, they're disbelieving the message right now the Fed's trying to deliver. So this question here from Secretariat Girl says, presuming a pivot happens, will it be when the Fed stops raising rates? So will a pause really be the pivot? Or will a pivot really only happen when the policy gets reversed, when rates start coming down and or they start stimulating again?
Yeah, hopefully you can hear me okay. I apologize to the folks for my fiasco there. So, you know, I think there's a bit of semantics here as to what one means by pivot. And, I missed a lot of the conversation that you all had as I was fixing my situation here. But I think there's a lot of wishful thinking that the Fed is going to start really reversing course. Even a pause, I think Mike might have mentioned the pig through the python phenomenon. I think that's still got a lot of playing out to do through the economy. And I think we're going to see that slowly play through and start to get priced into the market. You know, I was trying to share a chart that Tavi Costa shared within the last day or two, but I'll describe what that chart is. It's basically looking at inflation during the 70s, late 60s and 70s. And that's the boogeyman that this Federal Reserve and probably every future Federal Reserve is going to be worried about as they battle their own inflationary situations. If you look at inflation in that period, you know, the first peak was right around 1970. And then it started to come off. And then there was a bigger and more troublesome wave that peaked in 74, 75. That came off hard. And then the real doozy was the inflation that peaked in the early 80s. So, you know, that's a boogeyman that's hanging out there for Powell and his colleagues. The concern about getting too easy or pausing too soon and having this become a long, drawn-out, retractable, problem. And remember, Jackson Hole last year, he was pretty clear in saying we got to feel some pain. So I, you know, whether you want to call pivot a pause or a reduction, I think at most we'll see a reduction in the pace, maybe a pause. But I'd be very surprised anytime soon if we saw an outright reversal in lowering rates. I guess all bets are off if I think it was Steen Jacobson last week talked about if there is some kind of distress in the treasury market, like we saw in the UK gilt market, where that may be the checkmate that forces the Fed to do something in the easing department sooner than they would otherwise want to.
All right, great. So to your point there about pain, got a question here, really a statement by Good Humor Man here. The bear market's just starting. Thousands of jobs are evaporating. Thousands are pouring over our borders. You know, this is maybe an indication of some of the bearish sentiment that Lance was talking about earlier. and look, there's lots of reasons to understand why people are bearish. But John, you mentioned Powell kind of warning everybody that pain was coming. And I've long interpreted the markets that he's been making all through 2022 in many ways as the Fed is declaring war on the jobs market. Right. He just keeps talking about how strong the jobs market is and using that as a rationale for being able to tighten. Right. And I've had discussions with all you guys about the fact that, some of that data is kind of suspect, and B, it's very lagging data. But it seems that the Fed is still leaning on it heavily because it provides the rationale for the tightening of financial conditions that Powell wants to do. Two questions for you all here, and we'll start with you, Mike. How, from your own perspective, your own lens, and we're all prognosticating here, how bad do you expect things to get in the labor market this year? So, you know, do you think we're going into recession? And if so, you know, we're already beginning to see companies begin to lay off, but is this going to feel like a bad recession the way that, say, like 08 or 01 felt, where you had millions of jobs getting shed?
Yeah, I think so. I guess I'm about to be the one that sounds pretty crazy, because I tend to, believe that we're in a system that's been pushed to the limit, the absolute limit. And history tells us something's going to break. And of course, the most difficult thing about talking about these things is the timing. We don't know that it's going to happen this year. I can only tell you that the S&P 500, even at 3,900 or 3,950 today, is at or above the highest levels we've ever seen at the peak of prior bubbles. For instance, the tech bubble in 2000, or even prior to the housing bubble in 2007 and 8. So, and we're still higher than the peak in 1929. In terms of ways that you can measure the valuation of the stock market on a very reliable basis. So we've got a system that's absolutely stretched to the limit, that requires constant intervention at every turn, and that will not be allowed to reach equilibrium, lest everything break apart. Put that together with some bigger picture concepts, which are also really difficult to time with. For instance, the fourth turning theory. And I know that you've had, I believe, Neil Howe on your program before, who created that theory. I believe that we're in.
He'll be coming on again in a couple months when his new book is launched too.
Excellent. I really enjoy his work. I believe we're more than halfway through the fourth turning, which started in 2008. I know that Neil agrees with that too. And that means the next few years are likely to see climactic events. I can only imagine that the system that we're living in, that relies on constant printed money, and of course the fact that the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency, it's bound to break. I believe that the stock market is topping soon. We had a swing high in December, December 13th. We've now retraced about 50% of that decline. Where we stand today, I believe the market's going to roll over and have its first elevator drop down towards 3,200 or so. But I believe that's only the beginning of the bear market. It's likely to last longer, maybe 12 months or so, maybe 18 months. So timing is really difficult, particularly because we could bounce a little bit more in the S&P, maybe another 100 points before it happens. And nobody knows how long the intervention can last. We talk about the Fed almost all the time on every channel. Almost everyone in the financial press does, because we have to. But yeah, my long answer to your question is I believe jobs will get worse, probably a lot worse. If the theory of the fourth turning is correct, we're likely to enter into an economic crisis that's going to be pretty historical. And if stock markets were to revert even to long-term equilibrium levels, we'd be looking at 1,800 or so on the S&P and a total decline of 65 or 70%. All of those things are not predictions, exact predictions, but these are things that I would not be surprised to come out of the largest bubble we've ever seen in our lives. So thanks.
All right. So Lance, coming to you then. So, you know, we've sort of talked about what could happen with the markets. We've talked about what could happen with jobs. I'd like you to just to give your thoughts on what could happen in housing this year. I know you're a little bit of a biased commentator here because you sold your house, you're renting right now in anticipation of lower prices. Yeah. But given what you're seeing, you know, kind of nationally and what's happening on the macro level, obviously where interest rates are, where they may be headed, how much pain do you think we're going to end up experiencing in the housing market as a result of everything going on right now?
Well, you know, see, this is the whole problem that, you know, really kind of plagues. In fact, I'm about to publish an article on it, and I'm looking at it right now. It's called "Home Prices Will Likely Fall Further." So that's the name of the article. So, but you know, it's, if you take a look at the data, I create lots of composite indexes. You know, I look at what I call my total housing activity index, which combines all the phases of housing sales. So that's permits, construction, existing home sales, new home sales. So the entire process. And that's rolled over. And the reason it's rolled over is because there's a big spike in housing activity following all those stimulus payments, right? So we gave everybody money. They ran out and bought houses. That ran up prices. And what's interesting right now is that sellers haven't yet come to the realization that the money's gone, right? There is no more stimulus coming in. Interest rates are higher. You know, you're about to get into the same position I'm in right now, which is renting a house and looking for a new place to live. So we're putting in lowball offers on houses right now. And it's interesting because homeowners are coming back going, nope, I want this price. And I'm like, you're not going to get that price. You're going to get a much lower price. I'm just here first. So I'm going to hang out here. My offer stands. It's valid. Whenever you want that price, it's there for you. So they've got it. They've got a guaranteed buyer at some level. But, you know, that's going to be something that has to filter through the economy the rest of this year. Supply is rising. The number of houses on the market are rising pretty dramatically. We're up to about 8 months of supply. When you have a lot of supply and less demand, then prices are going to have to come down to meet buyers. But it's interesting, you and I have talked about before, it's a standoff right now between sellers and buyers. The sellers are still thinking we're back to, you know, 2020 and everybody's got plenty of capital. But, you know, that's just not the case anymore. So, you know, later this year, I think we'll see lower prices.
All right. So, Lance, I'm going to stay with you in 1 second, just because it's building on something we talked about on Saturday. You had said that you expected this to be a weird year for the markets, right? Yeah. Meaning that a lot of what we expect today may not happen, and we're going to have to watch things really closely. And I think I've talked with all of you about, given the type of market that we're in right now, the ability to call audibles as we get more information in the story is going to be really important. What do you think is more appropriate to think of the coming year? We just talked about, I think you guys all just gave good reasons why we could expect further pain, either in the stock market, in the jobs market, or in the housing market, or in all of them. Should we be thinking of 2023 as the year of pain, or should we be thinking more of 2023 of the year of the weird? So Lance, I'll let you start, and then I'll go to you, John.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, you know, it's easy to build, like I said before, it's super easy to build a bearish case, right? So I agree with John, right? I mean, there's, you know, a ton of reasons John and Mike are right, and you could have a much bigger decline in markets this year. Everybody's expecting that. And the one you have to be careful of is there's a, you know, look, despite last year, markets were down 20% last year, and you had the highest level of flows into passive index equities that you've had since 2008. So money flows are still coming into the markets despite, you know, negative outlook, bearish outlooks, you know, bad economics, bad earnings, you know, whatever. Money is still coming in. So because this is because we've trained people now for 12 years, and this is, go back to your question earlier, right? You know, is this a pivot or a pause? Well, a pivot is not pausing. Those are two very different things. If right. I'm going to pause, I just, you know, I'm facing forward, right? So a pause is I'm still facing forward. I'm just not moving anymore. A pivot is turning around and going the other direction. And this is the interesting conundrum. You know, everybody's going, okay, well, look, the economy's going to be fine. Economics are fine. Employment's great. You know, we're going to have a soft landing. Okay, if that's the case, the Fed's going to keep hiking rates until they get inflation down and they don't have to cut them. So there is no pivot. So the one thing that all the bullish markets want, and the reason people keep piling money into ETFs is they've got this fear of missing out on the bottom, is that as soon as the Fed pivots, markets are going to take off again. So they're going to keep just putting money into ETFs. But if the economy's fine, there's no reason to cut rates, and there's no reason to stop QT. There's no reason to go back to QE. That requires a Mike or John event, which is something breaks in the market and we've got a financial calamity in our hands, and that's where the Fed's going to revert to QE. That ain't great for stocks. So when the Fed pivots, I don't want to be long stocks. I want to be short stocks and long bonds when that occurs.
That's a great point, which I was coming to in a little while. So let's just come to it right now. So John, coming over to you, two things. One, give us your theme for the year. Is it the year of pain, the year of the weird, or is there a different word you'd use? But secondly, Lance is really underscoring something what we've all talked about a bit, which is, hey, the investors who are hoping for a pivot may end up getting that pivot, but it might not be the kind of pivot that they're dreaming of. right? It might not be the pivot that sends stocks back to the moon immediately. As Lance saying, it might be a pivot because something really horrible has broken and the Fed is in total triage with a bleeding out body, and that's not going to be bullish for stocks.
Yeah, I'm gonna be indecisive here, Adam, and say I think it's going to be both a year of both pain and weirdness. There's a lot of weirdness yet to unfold here, and I think there's a lot of pain yet to unfold.
Hey, Spy, you should consider running for political office, John.
That's but there's good reason to expect that. Look, we had last year was the worst year for stocks and bonds together in maybe history or a good long time. The bond market in particular got whacked relative to its history. But look, we're still, as Mike pointed out, we're still at sky high valuations that have only been seen in the broad market a couple times. Tech bubble peak in 1929. Doesn't mean we need to kind of reach the lows of prior generational lows, but there's still a lot of overvaluedness in this market. One of the jokes we talk about is when people go through the stages of market denial and fear and greed and all that stuff, and usually it manifests itself about the dinner table. Just think about the holidays we just went through. I didn't hear a single person talking about pain. In other words, last year was painful in the sense that it was a change in trend that folks had gotten accustomed to over the last decade or so, but it wasn't painful enough to get people to panic. There has been no panic in markets, broadly speaking. Bottoms don't happen until there's some whiff of panic and people are actually talking about how hard things are rather than just kind of being quiet at the dinner table. So I think there's still a lot more pain to happen. I think it's still going to be a tight monetary policy until something breaks or some real market or treasury functioning breakage happens. So, but along with that, there's a lot of weirdness. We've had a lot of weirdness the last decade with just recently. I mean, the market sells off on good news and rallies on bad news. That's weird, right? That's not how things are supposed to work. There's my answer.
Okay. Mike, coming to you, I want to ask a question that you other guys can feel free to piggyback off of if you want to. But we had a ton of stimulus coming out of the pandemic, right? Trillions and trillions of both financial and monetary stimulus. There was a ton of FOMO kind of in all the markets, but particularly in stocks on the speculative end for sure, and in the housing market, right? I mean, housing went up 20% in 2021, right? I mean, just bananas, right? And that was from pretty elevated prices beforehand. When I was interviewing Nick Jurley about the housing market, he made a comment that I think is actually potentially quite similar to the stock market, where he said, because of all that stimulus, we pulled a ton of buying activity from future years into those years, right? So now the issue is there's a buyer drought that we're likely to experience in 2023 because the purchases aren't going to happen because they've already been made, right? Curious what you think about that, Mike.
Yeah, what you're talking about is pulling forward demand, but that pull forward of demand goes all the way back to, I think it was 2008 for the Cash for Clunkers program under Obama. We were pulling forward demand for the next 4 or 5 years for car purchases. So we've had a constant fiscal and especially monetary intervention at every single turn, going back even longer than 2008, going back a couple decades. But certainly what we saw in 2020 was just once in history, once in a lifetime type event. $7 trillion of fiscal and monetary policy was basically created and put into the system. I mean, this created a giant bubble. I think the largest bubble maybe we've ever seen. It was a giant blow off top in 2021 in everything. I mean, we saw GameStop go to the moon, AMC go to the moon. We saw other meme stocks do well. And of course, the FANG stocks and crypto and everything. And like you just said, housing as well. A 20% move in 1 year for housing from already elevated levels is not normal. It's a blow off top. So I call 2020 the blow off top and everything. And the market tried to correct and has been trying to correct for over a year, topping in December of 21. I believe it was still early in what's likely a bigger corrective process. Now, we all have to be careful about predictions because no one wants to look wrong or because we don't know the future. But frankly, I do believe that we're at the forefront of a much larger decline in equity markets. And ultimately, housing, I do believe, will come down maybe 20 or 30%. Usually, a blow-off top is recaptured pretty quickly. So the 2021 jump in housing, that 20% jump should be recaptured pretty quickly. It's already been given back, at least for the most part, in some parts of the country. So overall, and I'm not sure if I even answered your question, Adam, overall, I think that this is, again, one of the largest, if not the largest top in our lifetimes, which means it will happen. It doesn't necessarily mean a crash like 1929. This is a rolling top. Tops take time to process. And, you know, frankly, I think we've got a long way to go from here.
Okay. Yeah. The question, maybe I did a bad job of asking specifically, but I think you got the spirit of it, Mike. And then Lance, maybe you can react to it real quickly if you've got a different opinion at RIA. But because we saw so much pulling forward of demand, given everything that I mentioned, does that lead you guys to expect that 2023, and we talk about sort of the earnings recession that we're expecting from companies, like how material is this reality that I just mentioned, right? In other words, do we think that, oh yeah, that's going to be a massive contributor to the earnings recession because we have pulled demand already into the years that have passed and Powell's out there trying to crush, you know, whatever demand is left with rising interest rates, it's already all priced in.
I just add a few more words and then I'll let Lance continue like you suggested. Yes, I think that's going to be material. Pulling forward demand, the last gasp type thing, absolutely. I think that, you know, there's some people out there I've read about recently that rushed to buy cars, before the end of last year, and that they're already very upset as these cars have been marked down in price. I mean, that particular news story, I think, was Tesla in China. Yeah. But I think there's also stories here in the States where certain models, for instance, Ford pickup trucks, are finally selling for MSRP instead of $10,000 or $15,000 above retail price. So yeah, we pulled forward. Anyone and everybody that wanted to buy basically, you know, has bought. And pulling forward that demand absolutely should impact sales this year. And not just vehicles, but in just about everything. So I think it's very material and comes on the heels of a big blow off top. And that's why I believe it's a negative thing.
All righty. Lance, any additional color on that from your end?
No, I mean, you know, look, you know, I you know, it's when you're making really long-term forecasts, he's absolutely right. I mean, look, we spent $44 trillion, because we've taken some money off here recently. But since 2008, we've put $44 trillion of liquidity and bailouts in the markets. HAMP, HARP, TARP, cash for clunkers, QE 1, 2, 3, quantitative Operation Twist, yeah. So forth and so on, right? So you add all that up, $44 trillion. And yeah, you throw that much money into an economy and into a financial market, you're going to get a big run-up in asset prices, which is, you know, exactly what's happened. Now the Fed is hiking rates. They're not doing quantitative easing. They're doing QT. I don't see the government coming to the rescue to send more stimulus checks to anybody anytime soon. And you know, this idea of what we call pull forward demand is exactly what's happened. You give people money, they run out and buy stuff. And now they all ran out and buy cars. There was an interesting article on MarketWatch the other day. A guy bought a house for $200,000 over asking. He's now decided he doesn't want to live in the house now. What's he going to do with it? Because it's lost $200,000 in value. You know, he wants to know if he can sue his real estate agent, right? And so, you know, this is, you know, but all these people have gone out and bought stuff and now they regret it, but they're not going to go and buy something else, right? They've already bought it. And so that lag of demand has yet to show up. And that is a very deflationary event. So, you know, in the next couple of years, you know, you could see a bigger deflationary problem. Okay, that's all fine and dandy. And that could certainly lead to lower asset prices. The problem is that right now, and this is, you know, we've had this discussion before, we've had a correction within a bull market. That's all that's happened. We're not in a bear market. If you take a look at the S&P 500, it's sitting right, it just bounced off its 200-week moving average, which is the trend line that's held this market ever since the turn of the century. And, you know, so you are simply just within a correction within rising prices. So from a technical standpoint, there's nothing wrong with the markets right now. We're not in a bear market. Now, when you break the 200-week moving average, you're in a bear market. You've got bigger issues. The question is at what point does the markets realize that it can't sustain these prices and these valuations? I don't have that answer. Nobody does. And so the risk you run is always, we've said before, is that trying to manage your money, anticipating a worst possible outcome, you're going to wind up losing a lot more money out of the markets than actually what happens during the bear market. So, you know, you've got to separate out these long-term views, which there's nothing wrong with them, versus what's happening in the markets right now, because those markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. And that works in both directions.
Yeah. Or maybe markets can remain weird longer than you can remain solvent, might be the theme of this year. Exactly. All right. Real quick, quick housekeeping. Folks, if you continue to like this monthly live Q&A format like this, do me a favor, just like this video. Obviously, if we see a lot of positive feedback, we'll continue to do more. Let us know in the live chat as well. I'll watch that right now and just get a live temperature check. Hope you folks are liking this, but if you're not, or you'd like to see us do other stuff, obviously let us know. All right, I got a couple questions here in the on the tarmac, but real quick, there was one that was asked at the beginning that I think was is probably just good for you guys to do a quick update on. And this is essentially, it's coming from Richard Arnett, who's basically just saying, hey, I'd like to know how RIA and New Harbor finished out 2022 versus the general markets. So New Harbor guys, why don't we start with you first? Mike, how'd you guys end up doing?
Yeah, unfortunately we were down a little bit, minus 2 points something. This is an approximate number. We have some dispersion amongst our accounts. Primary reasons we were down, I would say the biggest reason we were down a little bit is because of our call on long-term bonds. We stepped into TLT for a pretty good position. We've got a 15% position in TLT. We think it's drastically oversold still. We think we'll bounce pretty quickly from here to 115 or 120 or so. We still have a pretty inverted yield curve that will change, particularly if recession becomes widely known or we have a big S&P drop. So that's the real reason we were down at all. We maintained a pretty high level of cash equivalents. I'd say somewhere between 40% and 50% all year long. That we had some opportunities to quote unquote buy the dip. We did it a couple times, but we were never really able to get a deeper enough drop to take a bigger bite in the market. So we're not net short. We don't go net short. And even though our views are pretty negative on the market, we're very patient, and very prudent. So we'll sit on large cash balances and we'll take positions in the market, maybe to the tune of 10 or 15% as we see declines. We'll hedge them with options and we're prepared to react and adjust those hedges and increase those positions as well if we have deeper declines. So we always have a plan for that. So, but overall it was disappointing, down a couple percent. We hope to do a lot better this year.
All right. So down a couple percent, Lance, how about RIA?
Terrible question to start with. First of all, you know, here's the problem. So when you're looking for portfolio performance over time, you should never look at anything from a calendar year, January 1st to December 31st. It's a great marketing trick to get you to go jump into some performance. If I told you last year we were up 40% last year, you go jumping into that portfolio, right? Because it was up 40% last year, but it was all, you know, net short the market, double long leverage. And this year the market runs and you're down 50%. What was the point? And so, you know, what that question misses is what's happened in previous performance. So, you know, we talk a lot about the problem with investors is psychologically they jump from one performance structure to the other. And so they consistently lose money over time because they're chasing returns. So you should always look at your performance over a 3-year period. How have I done over the last 3 years relative to the markets? As a good example, yeah, our portfolios were down last year. We're just like Mike and John, where, you know, we were heavy cash. We were long. We had a position in our portfolio in TLT, which we're still long, and we're going to add to that pretty aggressively this year as we start to see deflation come in. But yeah, we were down about 4.5-5% last year on net. Now, we have a huge dispersion among accounts because when you look across accounts, we had new clients coming in last year. We had, you know, clients with individual positions. So, you know, when you take a look at, you know, across this big dispersion of accounts, you know, returns can vary all over the place. But what that misses is we were up 22% in the previous year. So, yeah, we gave up a little bit of those gains from last year. But, you know, this is what I'm saying. You've got to include, you know, multiple periods of time. This is why when you take a look at mutual fund performance, they always connive you into chasing mutual funds by giving you 1, 3, and 5 years. They don't tell you what happened if you invested in the second year or the fourth year of that return. Right. Of those. So it's a horrible question. You should never analyze any advisor by what they did in a given year, because
that's a great point.
What happened and what led to that versus what happened previously.
Yeah, it's a great point. I can see John and Mike nodding there along with you. Actually, now that we've got the split screen, everybody can see, which is nice. Normally I have to tell people. But one of the reasons why I felt good about asking that question is you guys both, relative to the markets, you know, dramatically outperform them, right? S&P down 20-ish for the year, whatever. NASDAQ down, you know, a good deal worse. From a partnership standpoint for Wealthion, this is a wealth building channel. What we're trying to do is help people build wealth over time. But a huge part of that is to try to, you know, really minimize downside whenever possible. I think you guys did a great job. I've made the comment, you know, that flat, you know, is the new up in type of markets like this. So I just wanted you guys to have a chance to A, honestly answer the question, but B, demonstrate to the audience here that, you know, both your approaches, and you guys do take, you know, somewhat different approaches, have both worked in really limiting downside risk in a year where a ton of people got slaughtered, you know, where they saw their accounts down double digits. And of course, it's just the indices that were down 20, you know, I don't know what the NASDAQ was for the year, 25, 30, whatever. If people were more heavily involved in some of the more darling stocks of the past, you know, 5, 6 years, they're down an awful lot more, right? The folks that really, you know, felt the siren song of Tesla or were in a lot of the big tech names individually, as we've talked about, you know, it's a lot of high growth tech companies that, you know, we're down like 70-80%, you know, in 2022. So wanted to give you guys the ability to answer the question honestly, but also to show the value that an experienced financial advisor who has, you know, a good portfolio strategy, employs diversification, employs risk management tactics, like the many you guys talk about, from cash allocations to hedges to gardening and all that type of stuff. Being able to avoid those big downdrafts is just massively important to building wealth over time. All right. So there was a marathon race over the past couple of days to try to elect a speaker for the House. I'm sure you guys all watched that. And I don't want this to veer into the political territory, but is it Kevin McCarthy? As he was going through just round after round after round of votes to become speaker and kept losing each one, he had to keep making concessions to the holdouts to be able to you know, get more votes. And I pulled up the concessions that he needed to make, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but as I'm reading them, I'm like, hey, actually, some of these sound like pretty good things. So I wanted to get your guys' opinion on just a couple of them. One, there's a rule that says any move to raise the debt ceiling must also be accompanied by spending cuts. Right? As I hear that, I'm like, it actually sounds pretty sensible. Another one was that he agreed to independent votes for appropriation bills going forward rather than just one omnibus spending bill. Right? You know, Congress is famous for just packing. It takes one popular initiative and then it just packs a ton of pork into that. So all the pork gets passed when the popular initiative does. It sounds like he's being pressured to say, nope, we've got to start voting on proposals more individually so we can't just do the pork package. So I'm just curious with you guys, do you think that those, what's your opinion of those? And do you think that that might make any actual difference in terms of bringing a little bit of fiscal sanity to Capitol Hill? John, why don't we go to you?
Yeah, I'll take a shot there. Yeah, that was pretty interesting political theater there over the weekend. I watched more C-SPAN than I probably have in decades. But look, politicians never keep their promises. Those things look great as you know they had to save face. And I'm not taking political party sides here. I think all our politicians have failed us miserably. But I believe it when I see it. Yeah, they sound prudent on paper in terms of what was called for. But I don't think it will actually be held. There's all kinds of backpedaling that will come. And, you know, so therefore, it's hard to even say what, if any, market impact. You know, look, I think much of the market right now is not based upon legislative things. It's based upon monetary things. So that's still the big elephant in the room. It's really not about, what happens in Congress right now in the big picture. So, yeah, politicians being politicians is my quick answer.
All right, Mike or Lance, anything you guys want to add to that?
Yeah, you missed the big one, which was term limits. So
yeah, I know. Like I said, I didn't want to make it too political, but yeah.
But no, I think it's a great thing. I mean, you know, the problem with a lot of these, you know, politicians, they get into office and look, why do we elect officials? We're a republic. We're not a democracy. We elect officials to go to Washington to vote the reason that we voted them into office, right? It doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on, Democrat or Republican. I vote for somebody. They promise me that they're going to do certain things. They go to Washington and then they get, you know, they just get lobbied to death by corporations and everybody else. And so they start voting, you know, laws in that are written by lobby groups or by corporations, et cetera, which have nothing to do with the reason we voted for them in the first place. So term limits is a great thing because now if they, you know, they have to go and they have to represent, you know, what they said they were going to do. Because in 4 years or 8 years or whatever the term limit is, they'll be out. So it removes some of that financial incentive, which I think is a good idea. The second thing is that, yeah, you know, voting on these individual bills is great. That was the way we used to actually run government prior to the World War I. During World War I, every single bill was, or every spending item was voted on an individual bill. And this kept some type of fiscal sanity in process. Once we got involved in World War I, we needed to do a lot of spending very quickly. So that's why they started doing just putting it all together into one bill, voting on it. And of course, everybody goes, hey, this is easy. Yeah. Let's just keep doing this. And then, of course, after we got into the 1990s and we said, hey, let's just spend more money. Deficits are great. We can just spend money to the moon. Omnibus became the thing. We haven't passed a budget, by the way, since 2008 when Obama took office. So that's a great step to going back to at least, and that was also another one of the agreements that McCarthy agreed to, was actually going back instead of using omnibus bills to and continuing resolutions to fund the government, actually going to have to go back and pass a budget, which it will at least provide some physical structure to how spending is done in Washington.
That's fascinating. I think I actually missed that part. There was one other one I liked here too, which was that lawmakers will now be given 72 hours to review bills before they come to the House floor, right? Which is like, wait a minute.
That's still not enough time. When a bill of 4,000, I don't know about you, I can't read 4,000 pages in 72 hours.
No, I can't either. But I mean, at least they've got 72 hours, right? I mean, you had 4,000 pages and you had to go vote that day, right? So it is a small step, but a step in the right direction. And again, to John's point, you know, politicians will promise everything and try to deliver nothing. So we'll see what happens as we go through this. But it did catch my eye that a lot of what was demanded in terms of concessions were of the financial variety in ways that I think we all are like, yeah, if that actually happened, it would be a good thing. All right, go ahead.
That's a two-edged sword, because yes, it will provide more fiscal sanity with Washington, but it will also extract these fiscal inputs, you know, stimulus checks and all that. That's going to be a thing of the past for a while under these new type of rules, because it's not going to be able to pass those very easily.
Right. And yes, I guess I was showing my bias that, I'd prefer we take our medicine and get to a, you know, fairer and more sustainable system, but it wouldn't be pain-free. I think we're long, long beyond the point where we can make any real reforms without pain, because we have let the deformations grow so large. All right, so we're in the last couple of minutes here. I promised I'd get you guys out within the hour. We have a question here from Stephen Heckler, where he's showing some pessimism about bond funds like TLT, because they don't offer the principal, the guarantee of principal return the way that a real bond does. Now, I know that both of your firms do use TLT. I also know that both your firms also will buy bonds directly. So I'll just give you guys a chance to respond to Stephen here. John, I see you nodding your head vigorously there. So why don't we start with you?
Yeah, we do own TLT, or a comparable long treasury bond ETF for most of our clients. We have no intention on holding those bonds to maturity. So therefore, that's not our main concern. In fact, the reason we use the ETFs is because we do a lot of option writing, covered call writing, and it allows us to bring in additional premium and take in some buffer on the downside on short-term peaks in that holding. So this is more of a short to midterm tactical trade for us rather than a long-term bullish thesis on the long-term treasuries. And that's the main reason. We totally agree. If you're looking to get a guaranteed yield to maturity, you want to own the individual bonds where you can do just that, hold those bonds to maturity and not worry about the maturity and interest rate risk that causes other folks to flee bond funds and eliminates your ability to manage that maturity risk.
All right, Lance, I'll let you give any other RIA comments on that. And then Mike, I'm going to come to you to begin to wrap things up.
We use TLT also. So we buy individual bonds for accounts. But look, we have some accounts, people just getting started out. They don't have a lot of money. We're trying to help grow their wealth, and they just don't really have enough money to allocate the individual bonds. So TLT is a great position for that. But the second thing we do in our bigger accounts is that we use TLT as an ability to increase or shorten the duration of our bond portfolio very quickly without having to sell one set of individual bonds to go buy another set of individual bonds. So, you know, if I have a 5-year average duration in my individual bond portfolio, but I want to take it to 7%, I can add enough TLT to increase, because that's a 20-year duration ETF. I can add just enough of that to increase my duration by to 7 years or 10 years or whatever, in order to take advantage of a decline in interest rates, where I get more bang for my buck capital appreciation wise from a longer duration versus a shorter duration. Right now, 90% of our bond portfolio is between 3 months and 1 year in duration. So, you know, that TLT adds a lot of benefit to being able to increase that duration as needed.
All right. Well said. And Mike, coming to you here to start wrapping things up here. So we talked about this being potentially a very weird year that we're going to have to pay very close attention to, probably a year that's still going to have a fair amount of pain packed into it. So obviously, everybody watching this video is largely watching it because they are trying to build wealth, they're trying to preserve the wealth they have, and they're trying to prudently grow it inside this uncertain environment. Any kind of parting advice you'd offer to folks, either based upon what we've talked about here today, or the many conversations that you guys are having with the people that are calling you up with, you know, these very real world concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, just decide, if for the people out there that are managing money on their own or passive investors, or even people that are with an advisor, I would just ask yourself if you're comfortable with your allocation, or are you comfortable with what type of investor are you? Are you really a buy and hold investor in a 60-40 portfolio? Are you really able to sit through whatever might come in the market from these historical levels? It's true, we can't predict what will happen, but a 50% decline from these levels wouldn't even really bring us to severely undervalued levels. That could happen. If you can sit through that and really sit through that for the long term, then you might very well be a passive long-term investor. If that's going to bother you significantly, if you're retired or within a few years worth of retirement within a few years of retirement, I'd strongly suggest you change your allocation. And when I say change your allocation, focus first on reducing your allocation to equities. I'm a little less concerned about the bond section of the typical portfolio right now, because bonds have already taken a big hit and I think they're likely to bounce. But having said that, you may want to make some reductions to risk even in your bond portfolio, particularly in the corporate and or junk bond space. But there are lots of opportunities. We're still about 40% in cash equivalents and T-bills, but there's pockets of opportunities that we like even now. For instance, emerging market stocks are still fairly valued, if not undervalued, in some parts of the world. We have some exposure there. We'll be looking to increase exposure to emerging markets going forward. And lastly, I guess I put a plug in for gold. I'm looking at a chart of gold. We've talked for a few weeks or maybe even a few months about a line that we thought was important of $1,820 or $1,820. Gold has broke definitively above that, trading at about $1,880 right now. Hopefully it can continue to build. But if it continues to build and breaks out further from here, the high level bullish wedge that it's shown the last couple of years would project about to $2,500. So don't forget gold and silver. Other commodities should also have a tailwind over the next bunch of years. So caution, reduce equities, think about real assets, and consider gold.
All right. And just to put in the plug for why gold is going to shoot the moon here is because, as I talked about over the weekend, I sold my gold miners for tax loss harvesting and have yet to cover that trade on the other side. And so, of course, they're going to go off to the race as well. I'm in this intermediate period. John, anything you want to add to Mike as we close up here?
Nope. We are on the same page because we pour our minds in this together in our investment committee every week, every day. So he pretty much put it succinctly what the way we see things. And, you know, we don't have any shrink wrapped plans here. We're always responding to what we see before us. But those are some of the big picture themes that we see playing out right here and now.
Okay. And emphasizing, of course, we talked about the importance of being able to make those audible calls as you get more data coming in. Lance, I'll let you have the last word, and then I'll give folks just a couple of quick little sneak peek into who we have coming up on the channel later this week, and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah. No, I've got nothing really to add to it. So all good to go.
All righty. Great. Okay. Well, folks, got a great lineup of speakers this week. As soon as I hop off of here, I'm going to interview Peter Buchvar. I'm going to interview Joe Saluzzi. You might remember I reran one of our earlier interviews with him over the holiday week. He's the expert in high frequency trading and the algos that drive much of today's market trading. Bringing Joe back on now because the SEC a couple weeks ago announced a bunch of new rules, basically trying to rein in what the HFTs are doing, things like dark pool trading and payment for order flow, that type of stuff. It's like a 1,600-page document that Joe has been slogging through the holidays to get up to speed on. He's going to come on and tell us basically what the importance of all that's going to be going forward. I'm also going to be interviewing Alistair McLeod, for those of you that are really big into the sound money side of things. And again, we get asked on this channel an awful lot, hey, you guys seem to have a bearish tilt. A lot of your guests seem to be pretty pessimistic about the markets. Like, what's the bull case? Well, we found the biggest bull we could find, which is Tom Lee from Fundstrat. You probably see that guy on CNBC a lot. I'll be interviewing him next week. So we'll get a chance to hear the most bullish of bull cases. And then you can all, basically make up your minds on your own after that. So in closing here, folks, no big surprise on this channel. We always reinforce, given the type of uncertain macro environment, the weird macro environment we have lying ahead of us, that most people, especially if you don't have a lot of experience successfully investing on your own, work under the guidance of a professional financial advisor. If you've got a good one, great, stick with them. Just make sure they take into account all the issues that, my guests and I have talked about here today. But even if you have a good one and you just like to get a second opinion of another one that does take all these issues into consideration, and particularly if you don't have a good one, consider talking to one of the ones that Wealthion endorses. Just go fill out the short form at wealthion.com and you can have a free consultation with them. Totally free, no commitment to work with these guys, just a public service that John, Mike, and Lance offer to help make sure that people can make as informed a decision about how to manage their wealth in 2023 as they're able to. And with that, everybody, thanks so much for spending this hour with us. Lance, Mike, John, guys, thanks for giving us an hour of your time. I know your weeks are very busy. Everybody else, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for watching, everybody. Thanks, Adam.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. Have a great week.
All right, guys. I know Lance had a noon ET meeting, so I know he just, not surprised, he just hopped right off there.
Oh, he just jumped.
I figured out what happened. I had the YouTube.